For this week, because some people are away, I thought rather than do some venial rules as such, we might have a look at. I'm revising the chapter in an essay I did some time ago on the Garudamas, and I think this is something that we talked about to some degree some time ago, but perhaps not since. I'm not sure how much we talked about it since some of the people here have been here. So I thought maybe to just take a chance to go through this chapter and then see if we can go over some of the issues that's brought up with the Garudamas and the different ways that we've discussed or can interpret them and look at them. And then if anyone has any new suggestions or new interpretations and so on, then I can just steal them and put them in here. Does that sound okay?
Intellectual property.
You've combined a couple of things into one proposition, Bhante, which are not mutually exclusive.
That's
the problem.
For the sake of health, I suppose Garudamas are a set of rules laid down supposedly according to the traditional narrative, as the preconditions before he would reluctantly consent to the ordination of his aunt and foster mother, Mahapajapati Gautami, as the first bhikkhuni. The Garudamas as such do not appear in the list of Padimokkha rules, being outside the normal framework of the Sutta Vibhanga. So looking mainly at the Pali rule. So the term Garudama has suffered much in the hands of modern translators. Garu literally means heavy, and in some places in the Vinaya, heavy offences are contrasted with light offences. So modern scholars have called these the heavy or severe or strict rules. Countless of interpreters have seen the Garudamas as an imposition of control by monks over nuns. So this is something I should probably give some more details here, but in the West, even the academic studies of these things, and I'm thinking of just almost everyone that you read from a Western perspective writes about the Garudamas sees them as an instrument of control. The idea the Garudamas are essentially about control seems to be influenced by the Christian virtue in both monasteries and weddings of obedience. Obedience is an appropriate virtue and an ethical system founded on thou shalt, issued by a lord from on high. Buddhism, however, is based on the ethical principle I undertake the training. This assumes a mature, responsible relationship with one's ethical framework and does not rely on a relationship of command or authority. So I come back to that point a bit further on. The word guru, when used in the Vinaya, normally has quite a different meaning. Has quite a different meaning. Respect. And the Garudamas themselves say this rule, this Dhamma, should be revered, respected, as Garukatwa, honoured and worshipped for the rest of your life, not to be transgressed. Clearly, Garudama means rules to be respected. This is confirmed by the standard Chinese rendering Ba Jing Fa, literally, eight respect Dhammas. I don't know what the Tibetan rendering of it is. Well, in the rule itself, it says that the rules should be respected. Yeah, but it's also the case that the rules themselves are about relationships of respect. Respect. Yeah, it's basically about how the bhikkhuni should pay respects to the bhikkhus. All right. different. You should do this. No, okay.
Oh. One.
One.
Oh, yeah, there were ones.
Yeah, that's good. Okay, so Garrett. Now that all the different ones don't have to be actual individuals, they can just be
a conglomerate. The hive, the connected.
No, they do that in the monasteries. Maybe it's. In the monasteries they do. You can pass Fifu or something like that. Eighth month. Okay, first Garudama. So this is the first in the Pali, not necessarily the first in all of them. Bhikkhuni be ordained for 100 years, she should bow down, rise up, make anjali, and behave properly to a bhikkhu or ordained on that very day. Okay, so I won't read through all of the things, but it's just up there for his read, but just look at the main points of interpretation. But if anyone, you know, notices anything or wants to raise any comments or anything I missed out, then please do so.
It doesn't sound like Buddha Bhaskara.
Doesn't sound like it?
Not at all.
It's got a different feel, doesn't it?
And it's very commentarial. It's almost like somebody with an Abhidhamma degree has come and taken the rule and then has quantified what is respect. Respect is these five factors. What five factors? They should bow down and rise up, make anjali, behave properly. You know, that sort of factorial analysis mindset's coming in here. And from the suttas, I never get the impression the Buddha speaks like this.
Mm. Okay.
Is there any reason to talk for this?
No.
Because usually the Buddha would talk to the monks with reason talk, or because he's maybe with reason talk.
Yeah.
And then lay down a rule.
Yeah, yeah. Here he gives the rule. There's no context.
Yeah. That's just touching. Yeah.
Sorry.
Thank you, one.
Oh, you are. Well, it depends if I'm doing what kind of English I'm doing. I've got English USA down the bottom here, which is entirely random. I don't know why someone has USA and someone has UK. As long as it's consistent, it doesn't matter too much. But that spell check will pick that up anyway. Yeah, unfortunately, English Australian, I don't think, does spell check.
Yeah, it just has a spell check.
It says what?
Yeah, it's a spell check. Which you download a dictionary.
Yeah, but it'd be the same as English. Isn't it the same as...
No, it's almost the same as UK.
I know it's almost the same as Australian, yeah.
It's different.
I think it's part of the default setting that they... There's something that they didn't do with the...
France is saying?
Something that they didn't do.
Anyway.
Okay. Behaviour. Okay, thank you. Okay. Unlike most of the Garudamas, this rule lacks a direct counterpart in most of the Patimokkhas. That is to say, in most of the Vinayas, the rule only appears here and has no independent corroboration. We should look at the exceptions to this below. Okay? So, I want you to let me know if the analysis is clear. I want it to make sense. Mahaviharavasa and the Vinaya, so the terminology is already explained in the previous chapter of the book.
So, the Mahaviharavasa is an exception.
This is the part. No.
Well,
Yeah, don't you usually, if you say you look at something below, it means you look at it further on in the text? That's how I always understood it. Is that right? How would you take that?
I'm suspending my disbelief, waiting for the rest of the text.
Well, it depends on who you want, who your audience is. You know, people who are used to that. You know,
are interested in the certain ones.
Yeah. Well, is there a clearer way than that could be put? My dad tries to teach his dogs the concept of later. you say Bicky or something like that. They get biscuit. They get it. Later. Okay. The Mahavihara Vasanavinaya elsewhere.
This might take some time.
Is there an echo in this room?
Yeah. No? Beginning of the Bhikkhuni Khandaka. It doesn't have actual thingy there. I can say elsewhere in the Kandikas, perhaps. Is it in the Kandikas? Elsewhere in the Kandikas.
Partridge Loves the Elephant. It can only come from one place.
Has a group of 10 Avandiyos, those who should not be bowed to. I'm not 100% sure that Avandiyo means to bow, it usually does, which includes women. But the context the rule appears in raises doubts as to the formation of this passage. It follows the well-known story of the partridge, the monkey and the elephant, where the three animals lived harmoniously by respecting the eldest among them. This story is found in all the Vinayas, but the sequel is very different in each. We notice that the Pali here changes from the specific list, bow down, rise up, make Angeline behave properly, mentioned in the story, to the general term, not bow. Not only that, but the content sends a completely different message. The whole point of the three animals story is that we should respect elders, but we're now being told to not respect women, even if they are elder. But the different vinayas each have a very different section here. The Dharmaguptaka has a long section listing quite different individuals than the Pali, although also including women. For example, the Dharmaguptaka includes a matricide, a patricide, an arahant killer, a schismatic, etc., none of which are mentioned in the Pali. The Dharmaguptaka also lists those who different people, such as novices, trainees, etc., should pay respect to, and adds that one should also pay respect in the same way to their stupas. Those to whom?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Those to whom? To whom? Yeah. That's a specific stylistic fault, isn't it? Putting two at the end. And as it one should pay respect in the same way to their stupas. The emphasis on stupas is quite characteristic of this vinaya and probably evidence of the lateness of this section. But the Mahishasika, Sarvasivada and Mahasangika all say nothing in this place regarding bowing to women. The references down there. And then a little note here which is also just worth bearing in mind. Incidentally, although this rule about bowing to women is sometimes inaccurately said to be a Theravada rule, the Yogacara Bodhisattva precepts say that one should pay respects to neither a woman nor a lay person. So that's a good one to bear in mind. People accuse the Theravadins of being sexist. You say, well, Mahayana is just as sexist as we are.
Do the other schools of the Dharmaguptaka also mention the Mahayana?
I don't think they say anything about the bowing thing there. I actually have to go back and check the details of the passage. I mean, if somebody feels from their own vineyard practice that something's wrong, as a general principle, you know, I don't think that you should ever make someone do something that they think is against vineyard. You know, even if you don't agree with that point, then at the end of the day, that is one of the things of vineyard, that it's based on your own sense of what's right and what's wrong. You know, so yeah, I mean, if I go to a monastery and they're eating cheese and I don't want to eat cheese in the afternoon, they don't kind of pin me down and force the cheese down my throat. Yeah. So I mean, it is an important point though, because it's something that even if people don't necessarily have, in some cases people just have very strong views about it and they'll never bow down to women no matter what you do. In other cases, monks would come and they just kind of feel uncomfortable and unsure, that they're not used to it or whatever. And even the nuns as well have also expressed that, you know, that they're also you know, not quite sure or whatever. So I guess just to be, you know, best thing just to kind of be gentle and just see how things go, to get used to it at the time.
Yeah. But also the country cheese that he was saying about my wooden for a suit. I can't remember what it was, but it told him that he either died or he had to leave and he left.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember what it was? Yeah. What we didn't want to do was something.
So, you know, anything to do with it.
Yeah, that would be different if there's someone who's actually sort of coming up through the ranks and ordaining here. If they couldn't accept it, or someone who's long term, then that would be different. Yeah. I mean, I don't think that would be really suitable. But if they're passing through or visiting or something, or staying for a short time, it'd be different. But yeah, in the case of somebody, I mean, I feel that if somebody really had serious problems with it. I think they should ordain me. They should, you know, they can go somewhere else. I'm sure I could think of a couple of monasteries that I'd be happier.
Which ones?
Which ones?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Those things will keep on happening. Yeah. Okay. So then, to sum all that up, that's the fact that the injunction against paying respects to women in this case uses a different terminology from the preceding passage, that it is based on a principle of gender rather than age, that is absent from most of the vineyards in this place, and that where it is present in the Dharmaguptaka, it speaks of stupas, all adds up to a clear conclusion that the passage is a late interpolation. All right. I can't find a place where they do, but that's why I'm left that a bit ambiguous, because I haven't been able to. It's a bit difficult. It's one of the things with like, if you can, you know, obviously I'm just using search to find them, so if they use the same phrases you can find stuff easily enough, but if they change the phrasing around, then it's quite difficult to hunt things down. So I'm not sure. Yeah, I'm really not sure.
And then there's the whole issue of whether it was for women exclusively
for women. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I haven't gone into that. I'm waiting for the Bhante Jag to do the research on it.
Well, Bhante, you give me 3 years to learn Pali.
I have.
Was it to learn Pali? there is a rule though about not paying respects to lay people.
That's from the same passage.
lay people versus women, though. Separate thing. Mm. That includes blokes.
I'm not sure. Yeah, I think it's the same. The ten avandios, which includes women. One of the ten people you shouldn't pay respect to.
Does it say men as well?
No. No. It's for bhikkhus, obviously, enough to pay respects to.
There's one thing in Vinaya where a monk did pay respects to a layman, and that's after offending him, and he wouldn't forgive him. And he was told by the Buddha to go and bow down. If basically there's all these protocols, ask for forgiveness. If that doesn't work, get another monk to come because he was embarrassed. So another monk comes as the witness and asks on his behalf for to forgive this person.
Yeah, that's in the Samatha Kandaka or something like that. In
And then eventually ends up bowing, I think.
I can't remember that bit. I know the passage you're talking about, but I can't remember that he bowed.
But I think the Buddha gave that. I'm not sure if he bowed or not, but the Buddha did say, bow at his feet and ask for forgiveness if that's.
I'm not sure. I have to see the chapter and verse. It's one of those. It's one of the first chapters in the Chulavada, I think.
Mm.
Yeah. But it could be. Yeah, could be. I mean, yeah. Okay, so there you go. Returning to the Garudhamma and the specific injunction not to bow to a bhikkhuni, the Mihishasika and Dharmaguptaka Vinayas include the rule as a pachitya, expiation, a rule which, when transgressed, we clear through a confession, and Savasivara has a related rule. Okey-dokey. So the particular rule is not found in most of the Vinayas, but we have got some related rules in some Vinayas. Else, when I say in the Vinayas, I mean in the Sutta Vibhanga, in the Padimokkha rules. The Buddha was staying at Sarvati. Now at that time, the elder Mahakasapa, putting on his robes before midday, taking his roll, went to a householder's home for alms round. Then at the place he stopped, there was the layman's wife. Seeing Mahakasapa in the distance, she got up and greeted him. But Tulananda was at that place first. Seeing Mahakasapa in the distance, she did not rise to greet him. Then that layman's wife bowed with her head at the feet of Mahakasapa. She washed her hands and, taking his bowl, offered plenty of rice with curry over it. Mahakasapa received it and left. The laywoman went to Tulananda and said, "Are you aware that was the elder Mahakasapa, the Buddha's great disciple, who is greatly revered by the deities as a virtuous field of merit? If you were to rise and greet him, what harm would come of that?" Tulananda said, "Mahakasapa was originally practicing another religion, Brahmanism. You greatly reverence that, but I do not respect it." The laywoman was annoyed and scolded. "These bhikkhunis say if you do what is good, you'll get merit. If you do good, you get merit. But when they see bhikkhus coming, they do not rise as if they were women from another religion."
That's contradictory to us. Now it says, "as if they were women from another religion."
It means as if, just like if they're from another religion, then they wouldn't respect the bhikkhus. And the bhikkhunis of few wishes, contented keepers of ascetic practices, heard about this, they were not pleased. They went to the Buddha and told him everything. For that reason, the Buddha summoned the twofold Sangha together. Knowing, he asked him. It's a formula which is presented in completely different ways in different venues. So in the Pali the formula is the bhikkhunis whinge, the bhikkhunis tell the bhikkhus tell the Buddha. In other vinyas, this is the formula, obviously, for the Sarvastivada. In other ones, the bhikkhunis will tell Mahapajapati, and she'll tell the Buddha. So it's completely different in different vinyas, yeah.
She would be busy.
Yeah. So, you can see how those differences in, which is just a formula, can give a quite a different impression in what role the bhikkhunis played. So, for example, if Mahapajapati is discussing bringing it to the Buddha, then, you know, it sounds like we have two leaders who are discussing how to look after their respective communities, you know. Whereas if you have the bhikkhus going, there's this kind of weird alienation thing where the Buddha's laying down all the rules for the bhikkhus and where the bhikkhunis aren't involved at all. But that's just purely as a result of the literary forming of the rule. Yeah. I haven't been able to find something out. I mean, it seems to me more realistic that the Buddha would actually lay it down to the bhikkhunis, but, you know, to the bhikkhunis themselves. But I haven't... That particular thing has been noted in the academic studies, but I'm not sure if anyone's done some detailed research to find out which seems to be the more authentic form. I mean, the other thing, of course, is that in real life things would happen in different ways at different times. You know, it wouldn't always be the same way, so...
This is a classic injunction that I was talking about previously. In terms of the Garadamas do not have this injunction here.
Yeah.
This process.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
There seems to be a history of conflict between Kulinada and Mahasabha.
There seems to be, yeah.
Especially Arahants. Arahants full of anger and greed.
Okay, so is it true that you did that? Someone's knowing he asked, is it true that you did that thing or not? She said, it's true, because the Buddha, for this reason, in many ways scolded. How can this bhikkhuni see a monk coming and not rise? Having in many ways scolded for that reason, he said to the bhikkhus, for the sake of 10 benefits, I lay down this precept for bhikkhunis. From today onwards, that precept, the 10 benefits is a standard list of benefits for the benefit of the sasana, the long lasting of the sasana, for increasing the faith of those with faith, and so on and so forth. From today onwards, that precept should be taught. Should any bhikkhuni, seeing a bhikkhu coming, not rise, this is an offence of pachitya. Sarvasyada. And then the little comment here at the end. Pachitya means burn, boil, smear, obstruct. If not confessed, it will obstruct the path. So this is relating to this idea of the antarayika dhammas. But the idea is that in the beginning of the Vinaya, when we recite the Parimokkha, it says if you have an offence and you don't confess it, if you know you have an offence, you don't confess it, this is false speech, and false speech is an obstruction to the path. So you're lying in front of the Sangha. So this is what that's referring to here. If this is the offence, if a bhikkhuni sees a bhikkhu and does not rise as a pachitya, straight away seeing and not rising, straight away at that point there is a pachitya. So that's all the analysis there. It's a very brief analysis. And just a little footnote here. The explanation is, so to describe pachitya as burning, it's evidently derived from a folk etymology connecting pachitya with pachati, to cook. Unfortunately, this play on words is sometimes interpreted literally, and students are informed that if they break pachitya rules, they will burn in hell. Needless to say, the early texts contain no trace of such an idea. People take this very seriously. I really believe that. She was listening to these series of Vinaya classes by this Vinaya master from China, Taiwan, and he was saying these things, and she was getting very, very concerned. A few notes are in order. Tulananda was Mahakasapa's nemesis, and accordingly a great fan of Ananda. Her misbehaviour, and in particular animosity towards Mahakasapa, blah, 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 her behaviour in this occasion is just deliberate rudeness towards a revered elder. Notice that this rule concerns only rising for a bhikkhu, not bowing, etc. We also notice that criticism by the laywoman specifically invokes the accepted cultural standards of conduct expected of women. Okay, so have a look at these. The second appearance of the rule in Parimokkhas, this time in the Vinaya of the Mahishasakas. Now this is similar to the Dharmaguptaka Pachitya 175, but in that case there's no proper origin story. It merely says the Buddha laid down the rule while at Savatthi, but the bhikkhunis did not keep it, so he laid it down again as a pachitya. So what this means is that laid down the rule as a Garudama. Okay, so this of course relates to one of the great structural problems of the Garudhammas, is that, say in this case, it's supposed to be laid down at the beginning of the Bhikkhuni Sangha, and yet it says, according to the Dhammaguptaka version, it says the Bhikkhunis didn't keep the Garudhamma, so he laid it down again as a Pachitya. Alright? So, you know, completely unprecedented kind of procedure. I mean, you just never do that. But also the fact, if that was to be taken seriously, then it sort of clearly suggests that a Garudhamma is less serious than a Pachitya.
But if these are in relation to
Now at that time, Bhikkhunis did not bow to monks, did not greet them, did not receive them, did not invite them to a seat. The bhikkhus were annoyed and did not return to teach. Then the bhikkhunis were foolish, without knowledge, and not able to train in the precepts. The senior bhikkhunis saw this, looked down upon it, and scolded in many ways. The matter was therefore told to the Buddha. For that reason, the Buddha summoned together the twofold Sangha. So in this one, he's summoning the twofold Sangha. Don't do that. He asked the bhikkhunis, is this true or not? They said, it's true. Buddha in many ways scolded them, did not I already teach the eight Garudhammas as suitable etiquette regarding bhikkhus? So again, this is the idea that the Garudhamma is already there, but they're not actually keeping them. From today onwards, that precept should be thus recited as part of the Parimokkha. Should any bhikkhuni, seeing a bhikkhu not rise up, bow down, and invite him to a seat, this is an offence of pachitya. The trainees and novices is an offence of wrongdoing. If previously there's anger and suspicion with no shared speech, which I think what that means is if the bhikkhunis and the bhikkhus are not in communion. So if there's a badly behaved group of bhikkhus who the bhikkhunis don't want to associate with, so say a group of Sikhs or Devadatta's mob or something like that, and they're not somebody who you'd go to and receive the award or anything like that, then in that case there's no offence. If previously there was anger and suspicion, I guess it's the same thing. Yeah, that kind of thing. Yeah, if there's some, you know, been some argument or problem or something like that, there's no relationship of trust with the bhikkhus, then it's okay.
Well, maybe it's relating to, part of many of the Vinaya rules which come about from monks in, abusing the relationship with bhikkhunis, asking them to wash their robes or sew them or something.
Exactly, yeah.
So if they're not well conducted that way, I imagine that'd be a point for anger.
Yeah.
Suspicion.
Yeah. So I think that's basically what it's saying, is that it has to, you know, bhikkhunis have to be consenting to it. That bit is very fishy, So, but the interesting thing about this particular one, because each one has quite a different context. Like in the Garudhammas itself, there's no context. It just seems to be laid down to control Mahapajapati's behaviour. In the Sarvastivadin one, it's because of the bad behaviour of Tulananda when Kassapa's going on alms round. And it's not, yeah. And you know, even though the Garudhamma itself says, you know, any bhikkhu even ordained that very day, but obviously, you know, it would be appropriate to pay respects to Mahakasapa, you know. I mean, if Mahakasapa walked in the room now, everyone would kind of leap to their feet and stand trembling. And invite him in. And this particular one, let's have a look at the discussion.
The wording of this Bhante seems to validate the idea that the Garudhamma was an etiquette rather than some heavy, like some sort of pachitya thing.
Yeah. Yep.
Is this found in any of the other Vinayas? The concept of Garudhamma as an etiquette?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
And that it had already been laid down?
I think that already being laid down is mentioned in the Dhammaguptaka. It's mentioned up here. Yeah. Sarvastivada doesn't seem to mention. Okay. Here there's no developed story, only a formulaic background that's very similar to the backgrounds for several of the other Pachitya Garudhammas we shall see below. There is no common ground between this origin story and the Sarvastivada version. There is a valid reason for the rule in the context. It is a good thing to respect one's teachers. This rule is not an arbitrary imposition, but came from a genuinely problematic situation. One might question whether the monks were being a little precious in refusing to teach, but any teacher knows how hard it is if the students don't display a positive attitude. In ancient India, as indeed throughout Asia today, bowing to one's teachers was a simple and universally observed sign of respect and gratitude. Okay, so, you know, again, the context seems to have been, you know, assuming a context where the bhikkhus were teaching the bhikkhunis, and in that case, then they should pay respects. So that, and so the problem was that they that it was disadvantageous for the bhikkhunis. And if you, I mean, it is interesting if you look at all the bloody awful problems we had in India trying to get the bhikkhunis and nuns and that to actually teach them, and how you had to sort out and negotiate all these issues of who sits where and what sequence it is and who pays respects to who and everything, just so that you can actually negotiate a situation where they're sitting in the room and ready to actually listen to the teaching. Yeah?
That's the rule of maybe that's what the origin was of that rule. The first 12 sit in order, the rest of them,
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah.
Yes. Don't get involved in that process.
The bhikkhunis? In this rule? The senior ones, yeah.
Well, what would the senior ones do? Shouldn't they be teaching?
Well, they should be, but also the very fact that there are senior ones suggests that this was only laid down after many years, you know? That's right.
But surely the senior ones should know the rules by, you know, if you're senior, you should have been around, kicking around long enough to know the rules,
yeah.
I would think.
You would think, yeah. I mean, obviously they did. But they did. I mean, that's why the rule for teaching the Avaya was laid down in the first place.
But and they also had.
Sure.
Because they've also got, they would have taken seriously this rule about, I mean, was it one or two candidates per year or something?
Yeah.
What is it? That you can only ordain?
One every 2 years.
So, I mean, the ratio for juniors to seniors should be quite low. You would think.
Mm-hmm. You would think, yeah.
Unless they're all seniors all disrobing every year or something.
No, that wasn't comparing to the Sarvastivada as such, just generally that compared to the laying down of the Garudhammas, where there's no reason at all.
But it's not, I mean, you could say that that was the context, but the rule itself needs to be validated as saying, should any people
think of
rather than saying about
Baba's
teachers?
Sure. Yeah, that's fair enough. Yeah, there's a bit of a.
Clear that people don't.
Right there, the context has some plausibility, but there's a gap between the context and the rule. Yeah, no, that's fair enough. Yeah. Just do the three question marks so I can find all the bits that I need to look up again later. Yeah. Right.
It doesn't say anything more about the. I think the Aragon is the thing that often made me particularly problematic is that between the ideas, they're going down to it.
Yeah.
You could have heard his own
discussion. Yeah, it seems to kind of rub your face in it a bit.
It's an inequity that you can never apply, no matter what you're doing.
It's not the emphaticness, and that would, again, maybe suggest that the Garudham is more a developed form of it as opposed to the formulation here. Should it be Kunya? Should A be Kunya, not should A be Kunya? The story refers to the Garudhammas as already existing, but there is no question of an offence arising from them. It is as if the status of the Garudhammas at the time this rule was formulated was of some recommended training in etiquette, like, say, the Sekhiya rules, with no specific penalty attached. Notice how the rule has been extended, whereas the Sarvasivada speaks only of rising up. There are now three acts that must be done. Doubtless these three must be similar to the four elements recorded in the Pali Garudhamma, which we will look at more closely next. Okay, here is the Pali. Avivadanam Pachukanam Anjali Kamang Samichi Kamang, which I render as bow down, rise up, make Anjali, and behave properly. This phrase occurs twice elsewhere in context crucial for understanding the Garudhammas. First is when the Sakyan princes, including Ananda, ask for Upali, the former barber and vinaya expert to ordain first so that they can reduce their Sakyan pride by bowing to him. Elsewhere, we are often told of the problems caused in the Sangha by the Sakyans and their pride. Nanda, who famously went forth on account of 500 pink-footed celestial nymphs and who wore makeup as a monk. Channa, the Buddha's incorrigible charioteer, who on the Buddha's deathbed was given the supreme punishment, i.e. the sarna treatment. Upananda, who constantly harassed the lay supporters for fine requisites. And of course Devadatta, who tried to kill the Buddha. Tradition says their pride caused them to grievously insult Vidurabha, king of Kosala, who in revenge has destroyed the Sakyan Republic and scattered the clan. Thus the Sakyan pride has become legendary in the traditions of the Buddha's clan. Which bit?
The Sakyan. Says
yeah. No, no. Okay. The Sakyan. Says the Sakyan. Pride. Yeah, it's pretty, seems to be, I think it's, it seems to be pretty general in the Buddhist tradition as far as I'm aware. In the traditions? The Sakyans.
Should the
traditions regarding
change to lineage, maybe?
Regarding the Buddhist clan.
What does that mean? Legendary in the traditions, what does traditions mean there? Does it mean in terms of like lineage of the Buddhist clan, or? That might have
been. Traditions in the different schools of Buddhism.
As the Sakyan pride has become legendary in the traditions regarding the Buddhist clan.
In legend?
I'm just short on the
traditions.
What does the traditions mean in that context?
Just whatever's being passed down, or the kind of the general knowledge in the Buddhist community about the Buddhist clan. Okay. Like if you mention to any kind of, you know, not fairly knowledgeable Buddhist about the Sakyan pride, they will always recognize, oh yeah, the Sakyans are very proud people.
Says,
of course, the Sakyans. Right. Is this sentence okay? Does that make sense?
For me, tradition is a bit. I don't know.
A question. I'll just take that.
I just finish the tradition.
Yeah.
Okay. It's become legendary, yeah?
We just say thus.
just tea.
Every tea to be a reductionist.
Is that fine? No.
The Buddha vibe.
Okay. Very good. The second time this phrase is relevant for understanding this Gaudama was when the Buddha said in speaking to Mahapajapati that it was not easy through bowing, etc., to repay one who has given the gift of Dhamma. The chief message of the opening of the Dakshina Vibhanga Sutra is that the Mahapajapati must give the Sangha its due and not confine her worship to the Buddha alone. May we be forgiven if we were to wonder whether this rule was not imposed arbitrarily on all nuns for all time, but on Mahapajapati alone for the curbing of the Sakyan pride and personal love of Siddhartha. Is it surprising that he or she is again being reminded of the importance of respecting all the Sangha?
I actually think that Mahapajapati, she raised him, etc., etc., and was very affectionate. For the, it's not just Sakyan pride, I mean, she's just retaining. She's very affectionate.
Yeah. Yeah. Not necessarily. I don't think so. So, well, it's just, for example, for, you know, when my mother came to Wat Nanachat, you know, that she would bow down to me in the ordination ceremony, but she would also bow to all of the monks and things like that. That wasn't an issue for her. So I don't see why. You know, I don't think that's particularly usual.
She's got your mouth. She's got your mouth.
Touché.
It's on recording. It's on recording. It's good.
Yeah. She's the queen and all this kind of stuff. You know, I mean, I think it's
better than being a snooker player.
No, do you get the point between the connection between these? So the first passage I mentioned here is where you have the close, intimate family relations, and when they go forth, the same phrase is used for their going forth, and it specifically says to reduce their Sakyan pride. Yeah, it's exactly the same wording, and so that, you know, it's not a kind of sort of arbitrary connection. It's a very close textual connection.
Is the phrasing for the bowing similar to the one with paying respects to the parents? Because that's another place where the concept of bowing comes in.
It is. Yeah, it's the same.
It's the same phrase.
It's the same phrase, I think. Yeah, it's a strong phrase. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Mahapajapati herself confirms that this particular rule was hard for her to keep. After accepting the Garudana, she says she will treasure them like a youth would bear an adornment of flowers. Hardly has she gone, however, when she exhibits yet another womanly weakness, changing her mind and getting Ananda to ask a special little privilege from the Buddha, that they forget this rule and allow paying respect according to seniority. The Buddha refuses, adding rather oddly that other badly expounded religions do not allow paying respects to women, so how could he? If badly respect taught religions do not allow respect for women, I would have thought this was a good reason for well taught religions to encourage it. In this case, it seems the Buddha was quite correct, for this exact rule is in fact found in Jain scriptures. The following is taken from the Yukti Prabhoda with the Svopajna Vritti of the Svetambara Upadhyaya Mega Vijaya.
No, the recording isn't playing backwards.
Dated from the 17th century, this presents an argument on the status of women between the two main Jain sects. This is actually a major part of controversy between the two Jain sects, the Svetambara and the Digambara. And the name of the words of those two sects essentially means the white cloth clothed and the sky clad. And the sky clad sect, the Digambara, asserts that to get enlightened you have to be naked, because to even wear one cloth, because normally they just wear one cloth, so even just to wear one cloth is already an attachment and you can't actually get enlightened. So even though some of the monks actually do wear one cloth, but that's because they're sort of on the way, they're not ready to give up all attachments. But if they're going to get really awakened, they have to give up everything and be completely naked. And of course you can't have women wandering around the place naked, is the underlying assumption for this thing. So that if the school which says that you must be naked also says that women can't get enlightened. Yeah?
So they both say that? They're both consistent in that?
Or? They're both consistent in saying that women can't go naked. Yeah. So this is the argument with the Jains.
The white problem is that they say that you can get enlightened.
Right. Right, exactly. Yeah. So it's interesting that it's a somewhat convoluted argument. Of course, makes sense from a Jain perspective. The work that's quoted, the Svetambara text Upadeshamala, appears to date from about the 8th century. So I didn't have access to the original texts on this. So this is quoted in a work by Jain scholar. Moreover, when nuns and other women greet a monk, a blessing is uttered by him in such words as, "Let there be meditation, let your karmas be destroyed." They do not engage in the etiquette of mutual reverential greeting that takes place between monks. If indeed, as you believe, nuns do assume the mahavratas, great vows, then how is it that between your monks and nuns there is no mutual reverential greeting of one another according to rank, as there is between monks? Indeed, this has been prohibited even in your scripture. As is said in your... Remembering, this is a debate between hypothetical members of the two Jain sects. As is said in the Upadesha Mala, even if a nun were initiated for 100 years and a monk were initiated just this day, he is still worthy of being worshipped by her through such acts of respect as going forward in reverential greeting, salutation and bowing down.
Sounds remarkably familiar, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So it's got cut and paste.
The Buddhist monks were jealous.
Of what?
Of the Jains.
Of the Jains.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
interesting, mutual reverential greeting is the theme.
Which is quite nice, isn't it? This is also something that was kind of seems to be, I mean, it's one of the things that the Buddha said that on his deathbed he said, well, now the monks just call each other by the same title, but then after I die then they have to use the sort of more formal terms, those junior and senior. So whether that was actually part of what the Buddha taught or whether that was just part of the kind of setting up of the hierarchy in the years afterwards is, you know.
Actually, that's a good point. But in the suttas, when we look at suttas where the Buddha has already passed away and the monks are discussing, I don't think they use the term Bhante.
They do, yeah.
They do.
That you can tell whether one is after or before the Buddha passed.
Yeah, it's quite well edited in that way. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Even straight after that, in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, it's that they switch the titles. Yeah.
You think it's an edit job?
It's hard to say. It could well be. Yeah.
Because I think that's one of the easiest things to back read into an editorial.
It would be interesting to look at it from the comparative text basis, but the problem is you'd have to look at it in the Indic to be really clear about it. Yeah, but certainly I think it's not at all implausible suggestion.
Because
yeah.
I would think if you think in terms of, I mean, everybody's got this a lot, I suppose, and not everybody, but most people I think would have this when they look back in the history, this view that everybody's got mobile phones and internet connection.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're going to have diasporas of monks around the place who weren't at the Buddha's death calling each other friend.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the mobile phone call, the Twitter comes up, oh, yeah, the blessed one passed away. Apparently now you've got to call each other Bhante. Guys, Bhante. Senior guy, Bhante. Like, I think it's a really unrealistic expectation.
It is, and it's... Exactly. And that's exactly what you get this corner who comes after the first council.
So who is doing the recitation, and then we got the first council happening.
Yeah.
Who's the one doing the editorial? No, guys.
Pasipan.
Yeah.
Okay. No, Tulananda wasn't in charge of the first council. Okay, the identical wording makes it obvious that here we are seeing not just a generic similarity but a direct copy. While Jainism is older than Buddhism, the Jain texts are, as here, typically younger, so it is not easy to decide whether this rule as it stands was copied by the Buddhists from the Jainas or vice versa. Nevertheless, the main point remains, this rule is one that, as claimed by the Buddha, is found among other Indic traditions. The key thing to notice is that the Buddha specifically invokes contemporary social conventions to justify his position, in exactly the same way that the laywoman in the Mulasarvastivada Vinaya story did. Is that Mulasarvastivada Vinaya? This raises the contentious issue of to what degree may Vinaya, the degree to which Vinaya rules may be, may be adapted according to time and place. As a practicing bhikkhu, I believe that in general, the essential aspects of the Vinaya remain as true and relevant today as they were 2,500 years ago. I do not think we should use as a blanket excuse changes in social customs to justify abolishing or ignoring Vinaya rules, even if they may be inconvenient or we don't understand their purpose. But in specific instances where social conventions are explicitly invoked in the rule itself, and when the irrelevant custom has demonstrably changed, we must question whether such a rule should be kept. And when, in addition, the rule causes unnecessary suffering, I think it is unjust and cruel to insist upon keeping it. Here we would do well to remind ourselves of the fundamental ethical principles embodied in the United Nations Declaration of the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. Article 1. Discrimination against women, denying or limiting as it does their equality of rights with men, is fundamentally unjust and constitutes an offence against human dignity. Article 2. All appropriate measures shall be taken to abolish existing laws, customs, regulations and practices which are discriminatory against women, and to establish adequate legal protection for equal rights of men and women. Article 3. All appropriate measures shall be taken to educate public opinion and to direct national aspirations towards the eradication of prejudice and the abolition of customary and all other practices which are based on the idea of the inferiority of women. This Garudama and some others are manifestly laws, customs, regulations and practices which are discriminatory against women. Discrimination against women is fundamentally unjust and constitutes an offence against human dignity. If bhikkhus wish to maintain the ethical standards expected in our international community, they must take all appropriate measures to abolish these practices.
Where's this quote from?
That's from the Universal Declaration of
Rights. No.
This quote from the article itself.
But did you just go to the paragraph before Article 1?
But this is also not similar to that put later. This is just the one again about women, but the one universal declaration of human rights has some more I can give you.
Can you get the paragraph before? So your argument is twofold. It's first one is that if there's instances where social conventions are explicitly invoked in the rule itself, then that's a good reason to get rid of the rule if those social conventions have changed. The second one is based on cruelty. But then you bring up a third argument based on So you're bringing up the United Nations declaration as evidence of standards to that.
Yeah.
Because the original land animal rule is said to be ecological social customs, and so therefore the social customs have changed.
But is that a contradiction, Bhante? Because you're saying above, just here, where social conventions are explicitly invoked in the rule itself, and where the relevant custom has demonstrably changed.
So the custom is not mentioned in the rule itself.
But we're using, we're using here as an argument the UN Convention.
But, in justifying the rule. Justifying
the rule.
Work to justify them. Where the text.
Because remember, it's more of the thing.
The text.
After but in specific, eliminate specific as a doubled up in that sentence.
Social conventions justify. Is it what's one justify?
Justify
it.
Yeah.
So when you say the relevant custom in the social convention.
Yeah, in the social convention, maybe repeat that. Yeah. In the social convention.
Because it keeps
practicing.
Under that convention.
I would change justify to necessitate.
Yeah,
it's not. I don't think it's just. Yes.
No, because the rule's already laid down first. Yeah, the rule's laid down first, and then later on she says, "Can I abolish this one?" She says no, and he says, "No, you can't because of this reason."
Because it's about land level,
better experience to have,
and then in the Jain context, it says, and in the meaning of first, it's hard to run.
Alright? Yeah. Okay. Okay.
I'd still change justify to necessitate.
No.
Because just, what? To me, just, the reason is because justify to me has a tinge.
Okay, Seven, that's good enough. Don't
worry.
Because justify seems to be that there's a problem with, there's a problem with the rule as it was, but when the Buddha lays the rule down, there's not a problem with the laying down the rule at that time because it's justified given this. Justified. It's necessary for that social condition. Justification is like you have to defend something.
Well, he is defending.
But is he really?
Yeah, he is.
Defending society.
But we could argue that
even in the day. Yeah, obviously it was. It wasn't accepted unquestionably. 99% of other Vinaya rules, the Buddha just gives the rule and everyone says, all right, we'll keep it, and there's a very few rules, like say the rule of eat in the afternoon or something, which were challenged, and the Buddha had to give a justification for it. So I think it's saying he's justifying it. It's quite accurate there. Okay. So now the rude shock of this. Well, another thing I want to talk about more, but I haven't talked about here is I want to talk more about the different ways that it comes back to the respect versus obedience thing, and to talk about how just talk about maybe a bit more how about in cultures and perhaps especially in Asian cultures kind of that whole thing of face and showing respects to people allows the kind of the social sort of greases the social wheels, so to speak. So there's some more discussion. Well, because we've had a look at some places where it seems, oh, you know, perhaps it wasn't just a rule for all bhikkhunis, it was actually meant just for Mahapajapati for an actual reason. And perhaps there were some other contexts where actually there was a reasonable reason where something like the rule came up and so on. So you're beginning to see, oh, well, you know, maybe there was some, you know, it doesn't just appear out of nowhere for all the bhikkhunis, but you actually say, well, you know, there was maybe some context for it. I just want to put some more discussion. I think that like one way of looking at the Garudha, that particular Garudhamma, is essentially to say that what it does is it creates the appearance of subservience while actually allowing the bhikkhunis to go and do whatever they want. Yeah, and so to say that, you know, that's not the whole story, but that's part of it as well. Because, you know, when the Western interpreters say that these rules give the bhikkhus command and control over the bhikkhunis, you know, the reality is that bhikkhunis actually had their own monasteries, they organised their own building projects, they had their own teaching schedules within that, they went on Pindabhata by themselves, they wandered across the countryside by themselves, they did so many things just on their own initiative. And it's not that the monks in any way were sort of standing over them, sort of controlling them in every respect. You know? So it can actually work, and it does actually work in at least some places today where the Garudhammas are, they allow a formal process where the bhikkhunis can sort of formally sort of establish a relationship with the bhikkhus, which sort of greases the social wheels of things. And having done that, they can then sort of go off and do their own thing. Yeah.
So what you're saying is, in a social context where the superiority of men is assumed,
right,
by adhering to form,
yeah,
you can basically satisfy the reactive elements within the chauvinistic male society,
yeah,
so that,
yeah,
you can go and do what you want.
Yeah, exactly. And that's in fact what does happen.
Yeah. So that is part of society anyway. So in showing face like this, they're just following social customs, and then really doing the other side of the really social customs, they do whatever they want to do.
Yeah.
But it's not out of context.
Yeah.
But so what he's saying is that it doesn't soften anything, it's just it keeps the, it follows the same context
of the
society, so it fits in,
yeah.
So it's fine.
Yeah.
Not so sure if it's the social context, wasn't that?
Oh, of course, that's not what I'm trying to say. I'm simply saying for people who are not familiar with that social context, to just put yourself into that position and say, well, actually, how might it have worked in that particular environment?
Mm-hmm.
It's like a lot of things, but it's like in that book about the what was that poem about the pigs and witches and stuff,
mm-hmm,
you know, and you see a lot of these kind of, you know, customs followed by the tribes in New Guinea or whatever, and you think they're completely mad,
mm-hmm,
then when you actually look at it in the context, yeah, it's still maybe a bit mad, but it's kind of got a it's got some kind of sense to it, yeah. So it's not I'm not trying to justify it, you know, or I'm not trying to say that it should be followed today or anything like that. I'm just trying to say it's, you know, to try to look at it, to try to imagine what it could have been if we look at it as sympathetically as possible, you know, and then see, okay, so how might that have worked, you know, rather than assuming that it's just simply, purely and simply a sort of control mechanism, but just how might it have been negotiated, that's all.
And the pattern is not something that just occurs in male chauvinistic societies. Say, for example, you may have a company that happens to have nothing but men,
right,
and then there's the boss who has the hard power,
right,
and then there's the PA who has the soft power,
uh-huh,
and the boss is a complete idiot,
right,
and the male PA just says, yeah, yeah, bows down and is always subservient in external behaviour, but everybody actually knows who's actually running the company, which is the PA. So, you know, it's not necessarily a male-female thing, it could just be conceptualised as a hard-soft power thing, so it's not even necessarily an Asian case thing. It's just what happens all the time.
But yeah, I mean... That's just a contingent thing, yeah. It just happens to be like that, And it's, you know, and it's, you know, I don't have any doubt that the institutionalisation of it is very problematic, you know. I don't doubt that. Okay, so let's have a look at some of the. Most of the other discussions are relatively brief. Bhikkhuni should not spend the vasa in a monastery where there are no bhikkhus. It's equivalent to Bhikkhuni Paccidium 56. According to the background story for that rule, some bhikkhunis spent the vasa without bhikkhus, so were unable to get teachings. The good nuns complained, and the Buddha responded by requiring they spend the vasa with bhikkhus. Here there's no mention that this rule had already been laid down as a garadhamma. If the garadhamma was already in place, the text would say the case should be dealt with according to the rule, which is the standard procedure in such cases. Since this clause is lacking, we can only conclude the relevant garadhamma did not exist at the time this paccidhiya was laid down. It must therefore have been included in the Mahapajapati story at a later date. A similar logic applies in the other cases where a garudhamma is found in the paccidhiyas, that is, garudhammas 2, 3, 4, 6 and 7. Okay, so the point is that most cases the bhikkhuni paccidhiyas already have the garudhamma rules, with some exceptions. Living without bhikkhus is defined by the Mahavihara Vasanvinaya as not able to teach or not able to go into communion. This suggests that it's all right if the bhikkhus are close enough for the bhikkhunis to travel to them for teaching. In pre-car days, this would have been a few kilometres, but now it would apply over a large distance. A more liberal interpretation would allow for contact via phone or email, since this would still allow the essential teaching to be transmitted. As always, there's no offence for the first offender of the paccidhiya rule, confirming the point we made earlier. When the paccidhiya was laid down, the garudhamma did not exist. So, you know, this is quite a serious internal incoherence, and it's one of the things that I find constantly with the Bhikkhuni Vinaya is it just has all these constant incoherences which you just don't find with the Bhikkhus Vinaya. And I just found another one, or just sort of researching another one this morning, in the Bhikkhuni Parajika rule. You have in the text, it starts out by saying, because the Bhikkhunis, you know, had the first four Parajikas from the Bhikkhus, and the fifth Parajika rule, you know, the first Bhikkhuni Parajika rule is actually their fifth, but actually in the text it just says the first Parajika. So it says the first Parajika, and then it says now the first Parajika is complete, now the second is complete, now the third is complete, now the fourth is complete, and then the very next line it says, well, now we've recited the eight Garudhammas. The eight Parajika rules for Bhikkhunis. Yeah? So it's just said, now the fourth Parajika is completed, and then it says, well, now we've recited the eight Parajikas for Bhikkhunis. Yeah? Horner? Oh, okay. In the translation? Okay, oh, I should check that up here.
I think maybe in wherever she covers the Bhikkhuni rule, she mentions that. Because there is some phrase, like such as before, anyway, something that includes three words that implies it's referring to a prior rule.
Okay. Okay. I'll have to look that up and see if I can find that. Yeah. I was just looking for that particular thing this morning. Okay.
Or maybe the 21.
show you. This is quite interesting. This is a website that has the. This is the International Tipitaka collection, and this is the World Tipitaka edition. So this is the one the Thai World Dhamma Society group just done their thing, and this is all their Tipitaka copies which they used for their collating their text, and they actually have one of them is quite interesting. They have contents again here. They actually have a scanned version of the Thai edition from and was it 1896 or something like that. So it's probably like the first Thai printed edition, I think, of the whole Tripitaka. And I'll just show you here. So this is quite interesting. They've got get the actual text here. So this is the Vinaya. What does it say? Vinaya. Vinaya. Oh, I can't read that. I don't know what this is. it's an early printed edition from China. It's Bikini Vibhango. That's not Pali, that's not a character issue. Pitika. No, that's Pitika. Okay, that's bits broken off there. They write the I differently than in modern time. Anyway, Vinaya Pitika, Bhikkhuni Vibhanga. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. And then it says, Pratama parajika. Okay, the first parajika. And then first parajika, and then it goes down here, it says, Tena samayena. On that occasion, the Blessed One, Buddha, the Blessed One, Sarvatiyang Viharati, was staying in Sarvati, at Jetavana Anadapindika's grove. And now on that occasion, Salho, okay, Migaranatta, so Salho, and then Salho is the character who appears in the first Bhikkhuni Parajika, i.e. Parajika 6, so it's just gone straight away from saying it's the first Parajika. Parajika 5, yeah, and then goes on to say this a few things. So let's see, that's how that goes. And let's see if we've got.
Antibiotica. So is that the origin story of the Bhikkhuni Parajika 1 in the old Thai version? Is that what you're saying?
No. It says Parajika 1, yeah. And then goes on to talk. It's Parajika 5 is what it's actually got there. Yeah, and that's the same in the PTS edition and the same in the other ones. Yeah, here's the Atawatuka. Let's see if it's got the Niptitan.
So does that set a precedent one day for the ones not to follow the first four paragraphs?
Well, I thought you'd cross my mind. I leave that one to be argued by the Bhikkhuni Parajika
experts.
What is it called? Panayayo? Okay. Chatutta. Yeah, here we go. Here's the bit that I was mentioning here. So here it's finishing the first Parajika. Sorry, finishing the last Parajika rule for the Bhikkhunis. And it says, Chatutta Parajikam Nirthitam. Okay, the fourth Parajika is finished. Okay, and then the very next line, Udita, recited, ko, indeed. Ayayo, meaning Ayayo. Atta Parajika Dhamma, the eight Parajika Dhammas. Yeah, so you can see how blatant it is. It's literally, that says the fourth right there, and then here it's saying we've now decided the eight of them. Eight of them.
So what's the point?
Well, the point is that there's this just a major discontinuity in the text there. Yeah. And it seems to be, I mean, looking at the PTS, seems to be standard in that particular problem. Yeah. Exactly, it's just slipped into the tradition, but it's not a problem to work out what's going on, but it's just that you don't find that kind of problem with the bhikkhus rules, yeah. That's fine.
But that's because there are bhikkhus using the bhikkhu vinaya who knows them,
yeah.
And they're working with bhikkhus, that's the thing, what's going on.
Yeah. And those things, they tend to have more structure in the bhikkhuni vinaya, so they'll tend to mention the four parajikas at the beginning. Yeah, so I'll discuss that a bit elsewhere in another chapter in this book. So say in the Lakutra Vada one, in hybrid Sanskrit, it actually gives each rule and has some discussion, at least some discussion, even if so much as to give the rule and say, oh, just the discussion is the same as for the bhikkhus. You know, but at least it's mentioned there, and the Pali just doesn't have anything.
In the Bhikkhuni Padmavati, does it have that at the end of the recitation of the parajika rules, say these eight parajika rules have now been recited.
At the end.
Yeah, does it have that phrase?
Probably, because it has it here. So this is an interesting point in the vineyards. So this is the Sutta Vibhanga, yeah. This is a section of the Sutta Vibhanga. So Sutta Vibhanga, you have the actual Patimokkha rule, and then all the analysis and explanation. So all this text up here we have is the analysis and explanation stuff, and non-offence clauses and so on. This is the non-offences and things. And so that's not recited. Right? That's all just, that's not part of the Patimokkha text, it's recited.
Yeah.
But this bit is.
Mm.
So this is the bit that's recited at the end of the section on parajikas.
Mm.
So you've clearly got the oral Patimokkha text and then other materials spliced in between it, you know?
That's what's sort of called me here, because you know the recitation would be very different to an analysis.
Yeah. You probably would find, you'd have to check the end of it, but you probably would find that would be there. We're going to have a look at
the. Don't need dead people,
obviously they're recite. They don't just recite before.
They recite the eight. Yeah, so that's why the eight are in the. No, there's a separate oral text of the Patimokkha, which is not included in the Vinaya Pitaka.
Yeah, but even the Patimokkha, I mean, the one to eight.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
And at the end of
that's right. That's right. In the Sutta Vibhanga is the problem. Yeah.
And at the end of each section, there's like a signing off. This section has been recited. I hit the venerable ones and be quiet.
Here's the section at the end which summarizes what's recited again. So this is the end of the Sutta Vibhanga. And it's reciting, it's mentioning what's been recited when you recite the Patimokkha. It says, Uditha ko ayayo nidanam. So the introduction's been recited. Uditha atha parajika dhamma. The eight parajika dhammas are recited. Uditha sata rasa sangahadisesa dhamma. And so on.
Can you find the section that's immediately after Bhante, the eight parajikas?
That's the one we just looked at.
That was that?
Yeah.
Was that from the Patimokkha or from the Vibhanga?
From the Sutta Vibhanga.
So, I don't quite
understand
it yet, where it goes from 4 to 8.
That's right.
Why does that happen and when? Okay.
They could have included the four bhikkhu parajika rather than putting them in there twice.
They're not put in there twice, they're not put in at all. So the four parajikas for bhikkhunis, the first four parajikas are not anywhere in the bhikkhuni rules. Oh, you meant not twice in terms of, but not in the bhikkhus as well, yeah?
So, so what you're trying to say is, when they start with the bhikkhuni text, they just start with number five.
That's right, yeah.
So here's the clarifier.
Blah blah blah. Bhikkhuni Vibhanga. This is a table of contents.
Yes.
Mejana Dhamma Sikapada. Okay, the Parajika, the Dhamma on sexual intercourse. Alright. Blah blah. It's not there. That's the same page we were looking at before. Alright. So this says, the table of contents says this is the rule on sexual intercourse. The text has nothing on the rule on sexual intercourse.
Okay.
And it says first parajika. Yeah? Yeah, it says the Vibhanga, first parajika. It then goes on to tell the story of Salha.
Yeah. And
parajika number five. Yeah, exactly. And then goes through the parajika number 5, 6, 7, and 8. And at the end of parajika 8, it says parajika 4 has been recited. The fourth parajika has been recited. Yes. The fourth parajika is complete.
And that would have been the conclusion to the
commentary
section
after
the chant.
That's right, the conclusion to the Sutta Vibhanga. In the.
What I'm saying is that the fourth has been recited. At the end, there's a little passage for the reciter, so that he can go over in his head what he has been done and see if he's missed anything. And so, by saying four, so he's done the prophecy, but he's done four prayers, but it's not finished.
Mm. Yeah, and so here's the end of the Sutta Vibhanga, the last page of the Sutta Vibhanga on Parajikas.
Yeah,
and here it says that the fourth Parajika has finished, and then the very next line it says, the eight parajikas have been recited.
At the end of each section, they put in a little thing that helps them remember, so that if they've forgot anything in the recitation, then they can, I forgot that. So, same as if I give you an example, at the end of one verse, they'll say, there's the cape, they'll say, the monkey, the wild baby, while doing this, while this, and they'll give you just a little memory jokes for the recital, and so that the recital, once he goes over that, then he knows if he forgot anything.
How do you explain that he said, I've finished reciting the fourth parajika, now I've recited the eighth parajika?
No, he's not saying that. He only says that middle section there as a commentary gloss, as a metric there. Because there's four, because he only recites four, but then the text continues to go on with what it usually goes on.
We're getting a bit complicated here. There's two texts. There's the Sutta Vibhanga, which only mentions four parajikas for bhikkhunis. This is the fourth, okay, on the eight things. There's the Parimokkha, which mentions eight parajikas, which lists eight parajikas for bhikkhunis, but is not found within the Tripitaka as such, is passed down as an oral tradition only among the bhikkhunis. Okay? Nevertheless, although the eight parajikas are not found as such within the Pitaka and the Sutta Vibhanga, it always refers to the eight parajika dhammas. So it's universally accepted that the eight parajika dhammas. However, in the actual text itself, it doesn't give them the proper numbers. Okay, this should be the eighth according to all of the vineyards and all of the way that it's presented. This rule here is the eighth parajika, and yet it lists them as the first, second, third and fourth parajika. So the text is clearly incoherent. It's referring to this as the fourth parajika, whereas clearly it should be the eighth.
Okay, so that's what I was meaning before about the Padimokkha itself.
Yeah.
I mean, the Sutta Vibhanga, but the Sutta Vibhanga includes commentary that's never recited at the Padimokkha.
That's right.
But that's what I was getting at, like at that end section of the Padimokkha, it will have that key phrase, these eight rules have been recited, and that will be handed down orally. But when you hit this, you hit a big editorial problem.
Yeah.
Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, but I don't think it's particularly relevant. I think it's just an editorial mistake.
Yeah.
Whether it's part of the oral tradition or not is a bit speculative. It could easily have been introduced at any point in the textual transmission.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. So otherwise the fault is superfluous, and the only reason for it is to show that there is some fault in the text, but it doesn't really necessarily affect it. The only thing that affects the show is to say that four are included in the actual chanting. The first four are not reciting.
Yeah. Let's move on. I just wanted to point out that was that the Bhikkhuni Vinaya is much less coherent and consistent all the way through than the Bhikkhu Vinaya. That's really the only point that I was trying to make. Okay? So,
to get all of the rules, you've got to find more books.
Okay, Garudama 3. Each fortnight, the Bhikkhunis should expect two things from the Bhikkhu Sangha: questioning regarding the Upasatha and being approached for teaching. This is identical to Mahaviharavasa and Bhikkhuni Pachitiya 59. There, the origin story is stock, merely instantiating the rule. This time, it is the monks who complain. The Dharmaguptaka Vinaya origin story says that the nuns had heard that the Buddha had laid down a rule requiring a fortnightly teaching. Just below, the same thing is said of the requirement for the invitation at the end of the reign's residence. Obviously, then, these rules cannot have been laid down at the start of the Bhikkhuni order. As always, this is confirmed when the text says there is no offence for the first offender. This rule, like the previous, was intended to ensure the proper education of the Bhikkhunis. It is about what the monks should do for the nuns. We have already seen that this was the reason given also for the paying respects to monks, so that they would return to give teaching. There is a corresponding rule in the monks' pachitiyas. This was prompted by the group of six who, for the sake of games, went to teach the bhikkhunis, but just after just a little Dhamma talk, they spent the rest of the day indulging in frivolous chit-chat. When asked by the Buddha whether the teaching was effective, they complained about the monks' conduct. As shown below, this is just one of many places that show the bhikkhunis were quite able to criticise monks, despite the Garudama that apparently forbids admonition. The Buddha then laid down a rule ensuring that the bhikkhu who was to teach the bhikkhunis was competent, especially noting that he must also be liked and agreeable to the bhikkhunis.
Should have been especially after competent, comma, especially.
We'll have a committee on that one. Have an encounter group. Like, I remember Paul Keating's wonderful comments about the Labour Party. He said, oh, these guys are completely hopeless, they can't get out of the bed in the morning without having an encounter group. He was commenting about his own party. You know. This is one case where the cultural context is clearly relevant. Traditional cultures usually make little provision for women's education, and some, like certain of the Brahmanical scriptures, prohibit it. Even today, nuns in many traditional Buddhist countries are illiterate and uneducated. Should say, often illiterate. Thus, this rule can be seen as a special affirmative action provision to ensure that the bhikkhus would share their knowledge with the bhikkhunis. The vinyas of the Vibhajavada group agree in defining teaching as the Garudhammas here. Apparently the most edifying thing these vinyas can imagine for the bhikkhunis is that they be told again and again of how they must be subservient to the bhikkhus. However, the Mahasanghika vinaya says the instruction should be regarding Abhidhamma or Abhivinaya. The Mula Sarvastivada says it should be on ethics, samadhi, and wisdom. The Sarvastivada Gautami Sutra should be Gautami Sutra. Says the bhikkhunis are to learn sutra, vinaya, and abhidhamma. The mention of the abhidhamma here is obviously, in its developed sense, is one of the three baskets of the Tipitaka, and hence is a clear sign of lateness. As an example of correct teaching, the Lokuttaravada gives the famous verse known as the Ovada Papimokkha, not doing all evil, undertaking the skillful, and purifying one's own mind. This is the teaching of the Buddhas. The bhikkhu is then supposed to inform the bhikkhunis that they are to have some discussion about this teaching. Whoever wishes may stay, whoever wishes may listen. Whoever wishes may stay, whoever wishes may listen. Is that leave or stay? I'm not sure. In all of these cases, the bhikkhunis are expected to obtain a full education, not just into the basics of etiquette, but in the subtle and advanced details of Buddhist philosophy. So you can see quite a different kind of attitude coming out in this one. You know, they're coming, because sort of gives a teaching, an example, and then says, well, if you want to come and stay and listen, we'll have some discussion about this, if you'd like to not to go off, and then that. So it's quite a different, and that's very similar. I think I mentioned that below to Nandakavada Sutta. If we can take this rule literally, as interpreted by the Vibhajavada group, we would expect that the monks would be approaching the nuns each fortnight and telling them to bow to monks. Surely this constant activity would have left some remnant in the suttas, but what does the evidence tell us? The Nandakavada Sutta features Venerable Nandaka going for the regular teaching of the nuns. When he gets there, he tells them that he will teach by questioning. If they understand, they are to say so. If they do not understand, they are to say so. The respectful manner in which the teaching is introduced, which is similar to the Lokuttaravada, reminds us that this was meant for the benefit of the nuns, not for their subjugation. The nuns are happy with this mode of teaching, so Nandaka proceeds to give a profound exposition on the six senses. The nuns are delighted, and so is the Buddha. He tells Nandaka to return and teach the nuns again. Nandaka is so clever at teaching the nuns that he's appointed the foremost in that category.
Was he also the one who was flying around in the air, walking back
and
forth?
Yeah, that's another one.
That's in the vineyard.
And then the nuns that's get locked out of the city gates.
Yeah, where's that one in?
One about they get locked out of the city gates is because of teaching after
sunset.
Flying around the air, that's in the Obi, in the Obada. It's in the Padimokkha, isn't
they
it?
They get bored of the same old thing.
Yeah, we're saying the same old thing.
Yeah. It's in it, and it is. And it's all right. I'll check it on it. The rule that the Owada each fortnight. Is there a person being approached for teaching? All right. So it's the fortnightly Owada.
So the nuns were criticizing him at that time for being boring. Basically, he gives the same dhamma talk every time.
Yeah. Okay, other occasions when the nuns are taught include a time when Ananda visited the nuns and they didn't wait for a teaching but told him of their success in Satipatthana meditation. Another time he taught four things to be abandoned: food, craving, conceit, and sex. When Mahakasapa teaches the nuns, the subject is not specified but is a talk about Dhamma rather than Vinaya. These are the only examples I can find in suttas of the monks teaching the nuns. If anyone comes to any other ones, please let me know. And the Garudhammas are conspicuously absent. So it would seem that the Mula Sarvastivada preserves the most reasonable tradition on this point. The bhikkhunis are to be taught ethics, samadhi, and wisdom. When this definition of the exhortation is changed to the eight Garudhammas, a rule intended to ensure support for bhikkhunis' education becomes trivial, if not repressive. It should not need emphasizing that the cultural circumstances have changed dramatically. In many countries today, women have education levels that are equal to those of men. In our monastery, the monks can barely muster up a tertiary degree between them, while most of the nuns have masters or PhDs. To insist on maintaining the old educational norms in such an environment is obviously inappropriate. Perhaps the rule would be better formulated in non-gender terms. Those members of the Sangha who have education and knowledge should share this with the less fortunate members of the Sangha. In the context the Buddha was working in, the division between the educated and non-educated would have coincided to a large degree with the line between men and women. And in the case of the uneducated monks, they could be expected to pick up learning from the other monks, which was difficult for the separate nuns community. In any case, no matter what one might think the rule should mean, the reality will be that nuns will take their rightful place of equality in the field of Buddhist education. Okie dokie. Gara number four. After the rains, the wasa. After the wasa. The bhikkhuni should invite both sanghas for regarding three things.
In regards to three things?
Wrongdoings that were seen, heard, or suspected, equivalent to Mahavihara Vasan Bhikkhuni Pachiti 57, the origin story shows Vaibhava's Pachiti 56. Again, the rule is laid down in response to the nun's complaints. There is a non offence if they seek but cannot find. That is what applies. They were living in a district where there were no bhikkhus who were keeping a compatible standard of vinaya. No offence for the first offender. This rule establishes a link between the two sanghas based on the humility of requesting guidance. It only occurs once a year and is usually treated in a formalistic manner. It is not so much the actual ceremony that matters as the absence attitude of mind it engenders. While the rules as they stand are clearly unbalanced, still there is no rule preventing the bhikkhus from inviting the bhikkhunis to admonish them. Garada number 5. On transgressing a heavy offence, a bhikkhuni must undergo manata, penance, before both sanghas. This is not included in the Pachitiyas. I put the offence here itself here in square brackets as there are crucial differences between the traditions. It is an important statement since the performance of manata is a serious and inconvenient penalty involving temporary suspension from one's status, exclusion from normal activities, and requiring a sangha of 20 for rehabilitation. Normally, manata is used for sangha disesa, which is the second most serious class of offence. The Mahavihara Vasan here, however, has garudama. Thus, this rule appears to be saying that the garudamas are equivalent in weight to sangha disesas. In this respect, the Lokuttaravada is in agreement, but the Dharmaguptaka, Mahishasaka, Sarvastivada, and Mulasarvastivada vinyas all say Sangha Disesa here, not Garudama, while the Mahasangika includes both. In addition to non-Mahaviharavasan, probably Sarvastivada, Sutta versions of the story, the Gautami Sutra at Majjhima 116 and T60 also say Sangha Disesa. One sutta of uncertain affiliation just says transgressing precepts without further explanation. So I've got a lot of references down there. Thus, the overwhelming weight of tradition here has it that the bhikkhunis must be rehabilitated from sangha disesas before both communities, which is the normal situation for nuns in the sangha disesa procedure anyway. The important consequence of this conclusion is that, as suggested by the fact that several pachiti rules had to be laid down covering the same ground as the garudamas, there was no penalty for breaking a garudama. There are a few places in the Vinaya that mention. Few places in the Vinaya that mention a bhikkhuni who has transgressed the garudama and who therefore must undergo manata. This would seem to reinforce the likelihood that manata is indeed the appropriate penalty for a garudama, but a closer examination gives the opposite impression. In the Vasupanayaka Khandaka, a list of reasons is given why a bhikkhuni may need to request the presence of bhikkhus to come even though it is the rains retreat. These include if she is ill, suffering dissatisfaction, etc. One of the reasons is if she has transgressed a garudama and needs to do manata. But, although our passage is evidently striving for completeness, there is no mention of the case where a bhikkhuni has fallen into sangha disesa and requires bhikkhus for a manata. This glaring omission would be easily explained if garudama had been substituted for sangha disesa.
You asked about any other stories of nuns being taught.
Yeah?
I believe there was a nun who was taught by Ananda. I'm not sure where it is.
Yeah, Ananda teaches Yeah, so there are no nuns or teachers who learn about Sabbath time.
Yeah, I already mentioned that one.
This is about a nun, and then she was embarrassed because she was trying to flirt with him.
Yeah, that's already mentioned there.
Is it?
Yeah. Oh. I didn't go into detail, but I mentioned it. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And what about the one where she's sick? There's another nun, I think.
There's one, well, that's the same one. She pretends to be sick.
She's sick, so she can.
Yeah.
Oh, how are
you? Yeah, no, I just mentioned that in passing.
Oh.
Okay. This usage, in fact, happens occasionally in unrelated Vinaya passages. There is a case discussed if the Upajaya has transgressed a Garudhamma and is deserving of probation. Here, Garudhamma obviously refers to Sangha Disesa. It seems that Garudhamma, in this sense, is a non-technical term that would occasionally substitute for Sangha Disesa. The usage probably fell out of favour with the rise of the more specialised use of Garudhamma to refer to the 8 special rules for bhikkhunis. But this would explain why there is an ambiguity in the Garudhammas themselves as to the meaning of the term.
Chris?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we see very strange of the word Garu, which is usually uniformly representing heavy, like Garubandha, for example, in the Vinaya.
No, it usually means respect, actually.
Does it?
Yeah.
What does most common usage mean?
Well, Garubandha means heavy,
right.
but the most common usage of Garu means respect.
Mm. So it already has inbuilt, though, that ambiguity.
Yeah. That's okay. Yeah. It does, yeah, it has that ambiguity in there, yeah.
In the section,
Jeez. That's fun. Okay. Garudhamma 6. A trainee must train for 2 years in the 6 precepts before seeking full ordination of the Sampada from both Sanghas. This is parallel to the Mahavihara Vasan Bhikkhuni Pachiti at 63. It's not identical to it, of course. The origin story speaks of nuns who were ordained without training and were therefore unskilled and uneducated. No one's going to pick me up on that? No, the ones aren't complaining? No? Ordained is actually an active term. Some people say you shouldn't use it in that passive sense. Who were ordained or anything. The good bhikkhunis complained, and so the Buddha laid down a 2-year training period. Here, the 6 rules are defined in Mahavihara Vasana and Dhammaguptaka as the 5 precepts, including celibacy as the 3rd and not eating after noon. Other schools differ considerably.
So, maybe we should put a reference in there to.
Yes. So, have you guys seen this particular thingy on the Sikkhamana site? Clergyman defends his Zen Buddhist practices. Cool. Village of fake Buddhist monks. Impersonating Buddhist monks is a hereditary occupation in Village 5 in the commune. The village of fake monks. There you go. Here's just as a quick reference. Here's the table of the 6 supposed 6 rules for the Sikkhamana in the different vineyards. Okay. And Pali ones, not killing, not stealing, brahmacharya, and lying, the first 5 precepts, not drinking, and eating at the wrong time. So Lakuta Ravada is probably going to be the same as Mahasanghika. 18 things. Should have the meal in position after the bhikkhunis, but before the samaneris. Okay, so it shows there's a position within the Sangha. Something that is an offence for her might not be for a bhikkhuni. Something that's an offence for a bhikkhuni would be also for her. She may stay in the same room for 3 days with a bhikkhuni. She may stay in the same room for 3 days with a samanaria. She may offer food to a bhikkhuni, except the 5 kinds of grains that may be allowable by fire. She may receive food from a samanaria. Bhikkhuni should not teach the parimokkha to her, except the parajika rules until the Sangha disesas. Bhikkhuni should teach her no sexual intercourse, no stealing, and no killing human beings. She should not attend the Uposatha ceremony, nor should she attend the Pavarana ceremony. If she committed any of the last four Parajika offences, she should undertake the training precepts again on the same day. If she's committed any offence down from the 19 Sangatisesas, that's a Dukkata offence. And then the last is the five precepts: eating at the wrong time, eating overnight food, storing food for the next day, accepting gold, silver, and money, drinking liquor, and adornment with fragrant flowers. Okay? So there's not a lot of overlap there. Mahishasaka, no killing, no stealing, no sexual conduct, no lying, no drinking alcohol, and no eating at the wrong time. So the Mahishasaka is the same as the Pali. Remembering that the Mahishasaka, Pali, and Dharmaguptaka are from the same group of schools, the Vibhajavada schools. And Dharmaguptaka also similar. No unchaste behavior, no stealing five coins, no killing human beings. So these are the extended definition in terms of the Parajika rule, equivalent to Parajikas. No lying about personal attainments, no drinking alcohol, and no eating at the wrong time. So Dharmaguptaka is similar, but more specific, more detailed. Sarvastivada, no unchaste behavior, no stealing, no killing, no lying. Okay, so they're similar. Basic four precepts. The lustful mind not having physical contact with a lustful man. So this is one of the Parajikas, and these not the eight kinds of misconduct with a man. So this is two of the eight Bhikkhuni Parajika rules there for the Sarvastivadins. And the Mula Sarvastivadins has six dhammas and six anudhammas. Six dhammas: not walking alone, not crossing the river alone, not touching a man's body, not staying with a man, not acting as a go-between, no concealing Bhikkhuni's Parajika offences. Six anudhammas: no handling money, no shaving hair of private parts, no digging, no destroying living plants, not taking food that's not given, not eating food that has been touched. I'm not quite sure what that means.
That sounds painful.
So this is a quite extraordinary situation. It's the only place anywhere in the Buddhist texts where you have a major group of precepts with so little agreement among the schools. Every other list of precepts, whether the five precepts, the eight precepts, the ten precepts, even the whole Padimokkhas, are almost all the same across all the schools. And yet we come to the Sikkhamana rules. Now, they obviously had a rule, you've got the Sikkhamana thing, and you've got six rules, kind of, except in some places they've got 6+6, and then 6+6+6. So you've kind of got this agreement on the 2 years and six rules thing, but seems to me that they had basically no idea what the six rules actually were and just kind of made it up. I mean, even the fact that these guys agree doesn't actually tell you that they had a common source, because they all just took them from the five precepts anyway. So there's really nothing in that that suggests that there was any common tradition as to what the six precepts were.
Do you think they might be faced something with the same problem that we're faced with now, trying to make sense out of this whole Sikkhamana business? And because of the lack of clarity back then, it's no different now. We're trying to come up with a whole list of things. It's all fragmented.
And this is something which is often said, but actually it's hardly ever found in the vineyards at all. I think there's one place in one vineyard which says that, but all of the other vineyards don't give that as the reason for putting the Sikkhamana precepts in. Most of the time, the reason given for establishing Sikkhamana precepts is because the Bhikkhunis didn't have education and they needed training. I can show you the... you can have a look at this... Oh, where are we going? Have a look at this site. So this is a site that we did last year, and this has a lot of all the information. So if I have the kind of the background stories, where would you find the basic... Mm. Having completion and training. Okay, say in the Pali here. So for example, at that time nuns ordained a probationer who had not trained for 2 years in the six rules. They ordained a sikkhamana who had not trained for 2 years in the six rules. These were ignorant, inexperienced, they did not know what was allowable or what was not allowable. And then they criticised it and then they laid down the rule. So that's fairly typical of the vinaya, that the reasons given in the vinaya itself is because of the training and education, which is what sikkhamana means. Sikkhamana means a trainee. It's not a probationary period. So just to compare with the situation, for example, where those men wanted to ordain who were from, had converted from another religion, and the Buddha said, you know, you have a 4 month probation period, yeah, so like a trial period. And so I think the word there is used is parivasa. So it's a different word that's used there, this actual word that's used for a probation period, and that's not what you find in the sikkhamana. Sikkhamana means an educational period. Yeah.
So this was a situation where women's education wasn't high, so it would have taken them a bit longer to learn things, do you think?
Well, recitation? That's one interpretation of it, yeah.
Should be
What I did was just change some important context. Yeah. So she's kind of, yeah. Well, yeah, it could be done more completely. But we just put it up there with the actual terms there to keep it clear. Yeah.
What's with that? Huh?
Is that it? Ordination. Who the beginnings? Okay, so just finish this Garuda number 6. Okay, so this is okay. In the Garudama, however, the six rules are undefined. So it just says they've got to follow the six rules. Since they are not a standard group, appearing nowhere but in this context, how could the nuns have known what was meant? Clearly, the laying down of the Garudamas was dependent on the Pachitiya context and hence could not have happened at the start of the Bhikkhuni Sangha. It should not need repeating that if this rule was really followed as described in the Garudama story, ordination would have been impossible. The nuns need to train for 2 years and then receive ordination, but if they are all trainees, who could they get ordination from? From whom could they get ordination?
So you think that the six rules could be the six particulars?
No, in the Pachitiyas it also says they've got to keep the six rules, and that's where it defines what the six rules are. Yeah.
Okay. What are the rules?
Or what it says in that table. Yeah. So it defines it in terms of how it says that.
But that's in the Vibhanga section.
That's in the Vibhanga. In the Vibhangas, maybe it needs to. In the Pachitiya and Vibhanga. It's in the Pachitiya context.
How long the rules were, or how long it was before the theoretical ordination of Mahapajapati to the first laying down of the Kuni vinaya? There's nothing to indicate that.
No, the chronology is just as confused as everything else.
Yeah. I mean, if we know the first 20 years there was no paying
for the big things. No, we don't know
anything. Well, we don't have suspicion.
No, there's we don't know anything. We don't know anything about the chronology of the Padimokkha, really.
Mm.
Yeah, it's just different traditions, that's all. Okay. Garuda number 7. Bhikkhunis should not in any way abuse or revile bhikkhus. I know this is going to be the hardest one to keep. Equivalents of Mahaviharavasa and Bhikkhuni Pachitiya 52, origin story at Vesali. An elder of the group of six nuns dies. They make a stupa for her and hold a noisy mourning ritual. The Pali's preceptor, Kapitaka, who was living in the cemetery, was annoyed at the sound and smashed the stupa to bits. Somewhat of a distasteful overreaction, one might think. Anyway, a group of six nuns say, he destroyed our stupa. Let's kill him. Kapitaka escapes with Upali's help and the nuns abuse Upali, thus prompting not a rule against noisy funerals or smashing stupas or attempted murder, but against abusing monks. Other vinayas tell the story differently. Again, the end of the rule specifies there was no offence for the original transgressor. His origin story has much of interest and has been exploited by Gregory Chopin in his essay The Suppression of Nuns and the Ritual Murder of Their Special Dead in Two Buddhist Monastic Codes, an essay which delivers almost as much as the title promises. One of the stories in that essay will reappear in the discussion of the next rule. We'll examine the story of the destruction of...
So respect is more important than, you know...
yeah.
Homicide.
Oh, right. Okay. Where? Nuns Stupa. Yeah, that's right.
When it belongs to a group, then the apostrophe goes on the end of the word.
Yeah.
If it belongs to an individual, then it goes between the S.
Yeah, it actually depends on how you interpret it. If it's the stupa of the nun who is dead,
then
it would be singular.
It would be singular like that.
But if the stupa that belongs to the nuns,
then it goes.
Actually, it should be singular. You'd be quite right. It should be because the stupa is built for one.
For one. Yeah. Like downtown nun in the small street, it should be the apostrophe
on the end. Yeah. Right. Number 8. From this day on, it is forbidden for bhikkhunis to criticize bhikkhus. It is not forbidden for bhikkhus to criticize bhikkhunis. This rule appears to have no counterparts in the Paticca Sutta school. It also appears to be absent from the Garudhammas of the Mula Sarvastivada, unless this be their Garudhamma 8. It's a bit unclear. I should check that.
You said Garudhamma 8.
Sorry, Garudhamma 5. Sorry. It is, however, found in the Garudhammas, most of the Vinayas, as well as the Sarvastivada and Gautami Sutra. The operative word here is Vachanapatta, which I've translated as criticize. It is often interpreted as teach, and in Thailand and other places it is assumed that a bhikkhuni can never teach a monk, but this is clearly ridiculous and has no basis whatsoever. I frankly find it difficult to believe that any serious Pali scholar could actually think that Vachanapatta meant teaching, since it's never used in that way anywhere. The etymology of the word is of little help here. Vachana means speech, and pata literally is path, hence ways of speech. We should have to have a look at the usage. Vachanapatta appears in only a few passages and has a consistent meaning. The most common passage is part of a stock list of things that are hard to endure. Here is a typical example of such a usage taken from the Vinaya. Monks, a person of less than 20 years age is not able to accept cold heat. Accept here is kamati. Cold heat, hunger, thirst, contact with flies, mosquitoes, wind and sun, creeping things, abusive and hurtful vachanapattas. Arisen bodily and painful feelings that are sharp, racking, piercing, displeasing, unenjoyable, deadly is not the type that can endure such things. So that's a stock passage. It's from the Vinaya, but then there's similar passages all through the suttas. Similar usage is found, for example, in the Lokuttaravada Vinaya, where a Pacheka Buddha is abused while on alms round. A further usage is found in the Kakachupama Sutta, Majjhima 21. Here, there, the Bhikkhu Maulya Phaguna was accused of associating too much with the bhikkhunis, so much so that whenever anyone criticized them, he was angry and attacked the one who was criticizing. And incidentally, sorry? Interesting, Maulya Phaguna was actually the friend in some of the versions of the stupa that was smashed by the monks. It was actually Maulya Phaguna's stupa, which was being worshipped by the nuns. Mm-hmm. Later on, the sutra explains 5 vachanapattas, hearing which one should endeavour to practice loving kindness. Vachanapattas are the time you're untidy, true or untrue, gentle or harsh, associated with the good or not, spoken with a heart of love or with inner hate. Structure of the sutta clearly refers these vachanapattas back to the initial criticism that so upset Maulya Phaguna. So we justify it in equating vachanapatta with avarnang bahasati, i.e. criticism. The same term avarnang occurs in Paticca 13. Formulation.
Nuns and monks in Paticca
13? Good question.
Just clarifying.
Bhikkhu.
So then you can criticize, say, about criticizing the community official. Is it
Because I'll just double check that. I think it's because the formulation of this Garudhamma in the Lokuttaravada Mahasangika reinforces the association with this particular context. This rule is a little confusing, for this school does not have an equivalent to the Garudhamma prohibiting a bhikkhuni from abusing bhikkhus. Rather, they seem to have collapsed that rule into the present one, so that while the rule formulation that seems to deal with criticism, the explanation deals more aggressively with abuse. And I probably should put in there somewhere what the Lokuttaravada actually does is the two rules on the criticing or admonition and then abusing, they put into one, and then they have an extra rule which says the bhikkhus should always get the best stuff, basically. Best alms food, best robes, best all the good stuff. So obviously that's, I haven't discussed that since it's so obviously unproblematic.
This book is not about supporting the Lokuttaravada of the
It's so good, yeah, it should be there, yeah. I haven't.
Crystallizing.
How would you process all this?
Yeah, okay.
Extraction.
Okay, blah blah blah. Okay, I'll put that here. Okay. It is not allowed for a bhikkhuni to aggressively speak to a bhikkhu saying, "You filthy monk, you stupid monk, you childish monk, you wicked, doddering, unintelligent, incompetent." I think so, yeah.
The monk's response, "What do you mean?"
The rule itself, in clear distinction from the Pali, says that a bhikkhuni is forbidden to criticize a bhikkhu about what is true or untrue, while a bhikkhu is forbidden to criticize a bhikkhuni about what is untrue, but may criticize about what is true. The terms true or untrue clearly link up with the Kakachupama Sutta. Again, given the similarity of the themes and the rare involvement of the bhikkhunis in a mainstream sutta, one may be forgiven for wondering whether this rule is in fact derived from the sutta. Okay.
Find it in touch with that particular rule. Is it a rule?
Yeah.
Because the rule states that we're supposed to be admonishable, isn't it? By lay people? Or not to. Not.
Yeah.
Could be. But I think all lay people and the monks should be able to be admonished by all persons, isn't it?
I don't know if there's a rule that actually says that.
Is
there something
about admonishment and punishment? Well, that's in the context of.
Because. Okay. While the phrasing of the rule clearly discriminates against the bhikkhunis, the rule explanation mitigates this.
Discriminates
against the bhikkhunis. The rule explanation mitigates this, for the actual explanations of how criticism is done by monks and nuns to each other is effectively the same. Both are permitted to admonish a close relative in a gentle and encouraging way, but are not permitted to use abusive language. So in the Mahasangika, it's got this kind of rule. The way that the rule is actually worked out in the Vibhanga seems to say that they actually could admonish each other in as long as they're being gentle about it. So it's almost as if like the Vibhanga itself is acknowledging a kind of more real life situation than what's found in the rule. You've got a rule that sets up this inequality, but then the way that it's actually worked out sort of mitigates that. So it's quite interesting. While Vatsanapatta then occurs fairly infrequently, the use is consistent and relevant in the Garudhamma context. If something whose main aspect is that it's hard to endure, thus it would seem to be stronger than admonishment. On the other hand, it may be done fairly and kindly, so it is weaker than abuse. This justifies my choice of rendering as criticism. The fact that this rule starts with, from this day on, is most curious. This is the only Garudhamma to be formulated in this way. It's scarcely possible to make sense of this without accepting the implication that before this time it was allowable for bhikkhunis to admonish bhikkhus. But of course, if this was the case, there must have been bhikkhunis to do the admonishing, and so Mahapajapati could not be the first bhikkhuni. There is, however, no mention of from this day on in the Dharmaguptaka, Mahishasaka or Sarvastivada. Okay. Mahasanghika abbreviates the stories of Mahapajabi's request, then prefaces the detailed discussion of the Garudhammas by having the Buddha declare that from this day forward Mahapajapati sits at the head of the Bhikkhuni Sangha, thus it should be remembered. It again seems highly unusual, without precedent that I'm aware of in the Bhikkhu Vinaya. Who was sitting at the head of the Bhikkhuni Sangha before this? If Mahapajapati was the first Bhikkhuni, as the tradition asserts, but which I do not believe, then it would be assumed she was always sitting at the head of the Bhikkhunis.
And it's not allowed.
Sorry?
Not,
what do you mean?
Well, it's not head of the Sangha.
No, I'm just saying she's sitting at the head, yeah? She's the first sitting at the first? He was coming down that pride in one sense, you know. Yep. And then elevating it. Yeah, that's very true. That's quite true. Yeah. I think there was a power struggle. Well, either real or projected power struggle, but between the first bhikkhunis and Mahapajapati, who ordained later and then became the kind of the ruler, either in fact or in projection by later generations. The mainstream position of the Suttas and Vinayata admonishment is that an admonisher should be seen as a gem. One should always follow them and never leave. The two Anyata rules found in the Bhikkhu Parimokkhas establish a protocol enabling a trustworthy female lay disciple to bring a charge of serious misconduct against a bhikkhu, which must be investigated by the Sangha and the appropriate punishment levied. This protocol is only established for the female lay disciples, not the male. Are we to believe that the Buddha made one rule supporting admonishment by laywomen and another prohibiting it by nuns?
But Bhante, this comes down to this term of the woman again. You know what I mean?
No, it's a different word. This is Upasika.
Upasika.
Yeah, see, so if you want to make your argument, you've got to be more precise than that. Yeah? This
is Upasika.
This is not Matagama.
Yeah, true.
Yeah? Sangati says that 12 lays down a heavy penalty for bhikkhus or bhikkhunis who refuse to be admonished, saying thus there is growth in the blessed ones, following that is with mutual admonishment and mutual rehabilitation. This, the last Garudhamma so directly contradicts this, it is a wonder it was ever given any credence. Nevertheless, though we cannot ethically acquiesce with this rule in any form, it is possible that its original meaning was much more restrictive. We have seen that the bhikkhunis were to approach the bhikkhus every fortnight to request teaching, and that this should be seen as a proactive measure to ensure the nuns received education. When they came to the bhikkhus, they did as so as students. The bhikkhus, if they knew of offences of the bhikkhunis, were to formally inform the bhikkhunis of these and were to leave the bhikkhunis to carry out their own disciplinary measures. Thus, it may be the case that this rule was meant to apply solely to a formal procedure within the Sangha, whereby the experienced bhikkhus could bring necessary matters to the attention of the nuns. If the bhikkhunis were so unscrupulous as to not clear up their offences as required each fortnightly uposatha, this would show they did not have the proper attitude necessary to receive the teaching. Okay? So again, this is not an attempt to justify the rule, it's just an attempt to understand, perhaps, one possible way that it actually might have worked. Yeah? So the bhikkhunis are coming to the bhikkhus for teaching already, and the bhikkhus are aware of some disciplinary infractions, and so in that context it might be appropriate for the bhikkhus as the teachers of the nuns to raise the issue with the nuns and to see whether they've been carried out properly. So that's just a possible suggestion. There seems little evidence that Buddhist communities through history felt that it was wrong for a bhikkhuni to teach or even justly criticise a bhikkhu. I have elsewhere gathered a series of stories that present nuns as criticising monks in various ways, and nowhere is this rule brought up. While these stories blah 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 blah. Okay, they're all prohibiting. So this is some of the stories in the Whiteburn's Red Rot. Rule books, ancient and modern, tell us what the rule writers wanted, not what was actually done. What is perhaps more remarkable is that I cannot find a single example where a nun is criticised or disciplined for admonishing a monk. The conclusion seems inescapable that either this rule was an alien interpolation from Mars or something, or its original scope was very narrow. In any case, the mainstream tradition tells us that it's perfectly okay for a bhikkhuni to teach, exhort, or admonish a bhikkhu in a general way.
You wouldn't call criticism an admonishment, don't you? Or it has to be in line with the rule? Mm-hmm. You say admonish? Because the only instance I recall of a nun criticising a monk was two of another criticising Mahakasapa.
No. You've got, for example, we already mentioned one earlier, where the monks, six group of six monks went to give the teachings,
yes.
And then they complained about that. Mm-hmm. And when the other monk we mentioned before gave the boring teaching, mm-hmm. and so they complained about him.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So there's like making fun of. Yeah. The needle peddler and the needle merchant.
And obviously that's the kind of thing which seems to be addressed here, yeah? Mm. That's the kind, you know, it's kind of unnecessary abuse and stuff rather than a genuine complaint, yeah?
Right.
Yeah.
So what justifies people's doing? What justifies people's doing
today? Oh, just anything.
I guess you
know. Yeah, no, that's alright. Okay, the Garudammas, an assessment, blah blah blah. We shouldn't spend too long here, we've been a bit long. If there's anything. Okay, the Garudammas make provision for points of contact between the bhikkhu and bhikkhuni sanghas at key vinaya junctures, or for sampada sanghari seta, for varanats vasa and upasita. None of these occasions give the bhikkhus any leeway to control the bhikkhunis. Both the bhikkhus and the bhikkhunis are under the overarching authority of the vinaya, and the vinaya determines what is to happen at these times. No power of command is involved, just a shared responsibility to respect and follow the vinaya. We should also bear in mind that while these are significant vinaya procedures, they do not happen very often. Upasampada happens once in a bhikkhuni's life, Sanghadiseta happens rarely, if ever, in the career of most monastics, Pavarana and Vasa happen once a year, Uposatha is once a fortnight. So that's a very important, and it's, I think this is really the one of the keys to the whole thing.
Yeah, and I have a quote about subservience from the UNHCR.
Okay.
Is there a rule for the bhikkhuni that they can't ordain more than once in their life?
No.
And why would you want?
Because they might disrobe and then want to come back to. Because isn't in the Mahayana traditions, I believe that's
yeah.
that true.
In some vinyas, taking these rules as the entrance points, most writers have concluded that the bhikkhuni vinaya is generally discriminatory against the nuns. But a closer look reveals that this is not the case. Yes, the nuns have many more rules, but many of the rules are required for the monks also, except they are not counted in the patimokkha, so the appearance of extra rules is largely illusory. This is the case in several of the ordination regulations, or take the Patidesniyas for example, where the four rules for monks are expanded to eight for nuns, but these eight are simply a prohibition against asking for eight kinds of fine foods, except if you're a six, is what I meant to say. Similar rules apply elsewhere to the monks, but the monks' Patidesniyas don't appear to apply to the bhikkhunis. Thus, while the bhikkhunis appear to have more Patidesniyas, in practice they have less. And then some more cases, similar sort, more important, some of the cases 3 and 4, which are serious offences for lewd speech. The bhikkhunis do not appear to have any corresponding rules. There is instead a special, do not have any corresponding rules. They said a special paradigma offence for bhikkhunis for speaking lewdly with a man, but in that case both the bhikkhuni and the man must be overwhelmed with lust, which presupposes a much more advanced stage of developing an intimate relationship. A bhikkhu, on the other hand, can fall into a sanghadisesa simply through an offhand lewd comment provoked by lust. Another example is the first bhikkhu's sanghadisesa for masturbation, which is treated much more mildly as a pachitya in the nun's vinaya. Some of the bhikkhuni's rules which do appear draconian may be questioned on textual evidence. This is clear, for example, in our discussion of the sanghadisesa rule regarding travel for a nun. Good, thank you. In addition to these, several other rules deal with particularly feminine issues such as pregnancy or menstrual hygiene. Others provide for the safety and education of nuns. And it is easy to forget that several of the bhikkhu's rules are clearly intended not for the exploitation but for the protection of the nuns. For example, it's an offence for a bhikkhu to treat a bhikkhuni as a domestic servant, having them sew and wash robes and so on. It is also an offence for a bhikkhu to accept food from a bhikkhuni, a rule that was prompted by the difficulty for women to get alms. Curiously enough, many modern Theravada nuns spend most of their days cooking, shopping, cleaning, sewing and washing for the monks, despite the bhikkhu's avowed commitment to the vinaya and insistence that this is the real reason for opposing bhikkhunis. For some unexplained reason, most bhikkhus don't seem to see this as a problem. This is, however, not always the case, for some respected Theravadan teachers insist that the monks actually practice such rules and not treat the Meichis, a precept nuns, as domestic servants. So that was Ajahn Chah, for example. He used to say that, according to Ajahn. I mean, I just didn't mention Ajahn Chah's name there because I only heard that as an offhand remark from Ajahn Jnana. But this is what Ajahn Jnana told me, that when they were teaching the Vinaya with Ajahn Chah, that he always told the monks that they should practice with the Meichis, they should practice the bhikkhuni vinaya with the Meichis, and that they shouldn't have them be their domestic servants and so on, although of course they still do the cooking. But anyway, that's what Ajahn Jnana told me. Now, I mentioned earlier that the Buddha is supposed to have said that the acceptance of these rules was Mahapajapati Sadhasangha.
Imagine people listening to this recording.
We tend to skip over details, ignoring the obvious in our certainty of rightness, so I must bodily lift the next fact into consciousness. Nowhere in this narrative are the bhikkhunis explicitly told that they have to keep these rules. The rules are for Mahapajapati. Yes, I realise that the rules are phrased in the general sense of all bhikkhunis, and I realise that elsewhere in the Vinaya expects the bhikkhunis to keep these rules, but in the core of the primary narrative, it is never directly said that these rules are part of general bhikkhuni ordination. I believe this stands as direct textual support for our thesis that these rules were originally intended for Mahapajapati alone. And then the next passage just talks about the 500 Sakyans who questioned Mahapajapati's ordination. What's that? Next one is somebody says, or that's up to 40 pages. We discussed that one. Yeah, some of the things which we discussed the other day, I put into the discussion.
When we did the class,
we did this. That's right. Yeah. I'm going through. So this is the first chapter in a book that I'm just doing on Bhikkhuni Vinaya questions, just trying to put all the different essays that I've done over the years on Bhikkhuni Vinaya into one.
A compilation,
yeah. Mm.
Because it's an oral transmission, do you think it's like that?
So if there's an oral transmission and there weren't any bhikkhunis, I don't know, that's why I'm asking the question. Because if you had a text, and you were living in a community of bhikkhunis, you had a text which you had to live by, that was your bhikkhunis, written on banana leaves or whatever.
I think it's very likely that what is lost is the you know, we have the kind of the oral text of the Bhikkhuni Parimokkha, And what we don't have is the bhikkhuni's own explanations and understanding of that, yeah.
Because what we've got is the bhikkhuni vinaya, but the bhikkhus
have. Exactly. Yeah.
So we haven't got the bhikkhuni vinaya that the bhikkhus use.
Yeah.
And I presume they, you know, some of them are very made to use it.
Yep, yep.
Presumably
it's had all of those things, yeah.
So they haven't had to sort of run next door to the bhikkhus to get to
And it's actually a very interesting topic, and I mean one of the themes of these bhikkhuni vinaya studies is precisely that this is what you constantly come up against. Now it may be possible by doing much more thorough research, because I'm just looking at a few points. You know, I'm looking at a few points which are actually practically important for bhikkhunis. I'm not doing a kind of a very systematic study, and nobody, certainly in the West, has done that. The Japanese might have, but who knows what goes on in Japan. But certainly in the West, nobody's done that kind of study. I don't even know of any studies, say comparative studies of the actual vibhangas of the rules in English. So it could well be that within those, somewhere in the vinyas, you might be able to find things which are actually part of that bhikkhuni's tradition, but it would be take quite a lot of work to tease them out and to sort of, you know, see how they could be identified. Yeah. There might not be. They got entangled. Yeah, I think you can see in the bhikkhuni parimokkha and in the kamavachas for the ordination and some of the oral texts, you can see a few terms, but that's all really.
So my question is, one of the answers yes then, there must have been a version of the vinaya that the bhikkhuni used.
Yeah.
At what stage though would they have written it, and who would have written it?
Yeah, and not a version, but there would have been an oral transmission and teaching regarding the vinaya which was passed down within the bhikkhuni's communities, which may have differed from monastery to monastery. In fact, it probably would have done right from the earliest days. So, you know, we're sitting around here discussing vinaya. Some people are down in Campbelltown or in Sunyataram or in Canberra. They're sitting around discussing vinaya and they come up with different explanations. And those get passed down by the tradition. And, you know, we don't necessarily, you know, even in our day, well, we could put all this stuff on a wiki and we could coordinate with, well, we could find it difficult to coordinate with one other monastery, you know, to figure out our vinaya interpretations. So you think in those days, so there would have been different understandings passed down through different traditions, and because the bhikkhunis weren't in charge of the centralising process, so that's essentially what the councils is. The councils is the process of centralising and standardising things. So the bhikkhunis would have lacked that and would have just had the local and regional variants. So, you know, you could have expected actually the fact that there's a lot more diversity in the bhikkhuni vinaya quite possibly represents what was there right from the beginning. But there's always been that variation.
Mm. I mean, do we know for sure that there was no...
Oh, they could well have done. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure they would have had some events for reciting their texts and so on. You do find it's one area where there's a serious discrepancy between the textual transmission and the inscriptural record. Because in the texts, there's no mentions of the bhikkhunis taking part in the textual transmission at all, except for a couple of occasional references. There's some references in the Dipavamsa, but apart from that, there's almost no mention of the bhikkhunis actually passing down the text. But in the inscriptions, there's almost as many references to the bhikkhunis as being learned and masters of the three pitikas and vinaya experts and so on, as you have to the bhikkhus.
What do you mean by inscriptions?
Inscriptions. Things that are written on stone. Yeah. Yep. That's right, yeah. So it'll say, you know, this stupa was donated by such and such a bhikkhuni who was a master of the three pitikas, or something like that. And so in those inscriptions, the bhikkhunis are depicted basically in exactly the same way as the bhikkhus are. And that's all over India for 500 years. You know, that's not a minor thing, it's a major thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry?
After the
knee. Yeah, you can see it leaves the marks, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Sorry?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a kind of question. This is all discussing Chopin's books. So if you have a look at Chopin, he discusses those things. It either means that they actually did have money and wealth and donated them, or perhaps it's an idiom to mean that they were, you know, the head of the group that donated it. You know, so that might, you know, it can be done. Even today, it can be done either way, and it could be, you know, it could be recorded in that way. Yeah. You have, I mean, both things happen today. So. But this is one of the things that Gregory Chopin's making, is that the Bikkhunis seem to have access to similar kinds of resources to what the bhikkhus had. Yeah. I mean, it's not a small thing to be able to say you can donate a stupa. You know, it'd be like our stupa, yeah? We say it was donated by you could say it's donated by Aya Santini. Actually, it was her supporters who got it donated. Yeah.
We should put an inscription up there.
We should, yeah. That's a great idea, actually. That's actually a very good idea. If we can find a good stonemason, we should do that.
I'm not very sure
that
they are in the position of the Bikkhunis ordination in China.
Mm-hmm.
I can't quite recall it, but
433.
Sorry? 433 AD. So at that time,
the
new that were practiced by the Sinhalese
monks. Uh-huh.
Which school do they belong to?
Well, it seems they would have belonged to a monastery called the Abhay Giri, which was one of the three competing main monasteries in Sri Lanka. So in Sri Lanka at that time you had the Mahavihara, Abhay Giri and Jetavana. And Mahavihara is the head of the school we now know as Theravada. Okay, but that was actually the smallest of the three in Sri Lanka at the time, and Abhay Giri was the one which had the most international contacts, and they were the ones, it seems, that sent the Bikkhunis over to China, and it was also that was from them, it seems, that the Chinese got their got a few texts which were translated, like the Mahishasika Vinaya and Samyukta Agama and a few other things. Yeah. So Abhay Giri. But what happened, the history of that is that when Buddhism came to Sri Lanka, originally, when it was first brought over to Sri Lanka, it probably hadn't split into schools at that stage. So actually it was just Buddhism that came to Sri Lanka. Now over time these kind of sectarian rivalries developed, and you had the emergence of first the Mahavihara and Abhay Giri, and later on the Jetavana groups, so three main groups, and they had a relationship which at certain times was very conflictive. So they destroyed each other's monasteries and all of these kinds of things, and they were competing for royal favours and so on. At other times it wasn't conflictive, but there were periods when they were arguing quite viciously. So they would have emerged, say, 1st, 2nd, 3rd century that these schools were emerging, and until the 11th century in Sri Lanka. King Parakramabahu II unified the three schools. Okay, so what happened then was that in 11th century in India was when the Muslim invasions were happening. Yeah, so Buddhism was being wiped out of India. Yeah, and so you can imagine that in the border regions there would have been a great fear. You know, are we going to be next? And so with the fear would have come a sense of consolidation. Well, actually, for 1,000 years we've been fighting with these guys over here, right? But actually, at the end of the day, we're really not so different from them. And so the king managed, he was a very powerful king, and he managed to unify the sects at that point, 11th century. So it's from about the 11th century. Parakramabahu, yeah, the second. And so from that time, then you had one school in Sri Lanka, one school which we know as Theravada. And that's also the time when that Theravadan school began to establish itself throughout Southeast Asia as well. So previously in Southeast Asia there would have been a diversity of different schools of Buddhism in different places. And again, because of the Muslim invasion and the threat, then there was like a unification and consolidation that went on in the Buddhist communities. So that's why the Southeast Asian area now is all Theravada. Whereas in fact, before the 11th century, the school, Mahavihara was just one of three schools in Sri Lanka and one of maybe half a dozen schools in the Southeast Asian area. Yeah. And all the other, of the other schools, Vaigiri and Jetavana, all their texts are lost and we know almost nothing about them, except for maybe one or two things translated into Chinese. Well, they seem to have translated the texts fairly accurately, so that the actual Vinaya Pitaka was just translated. It's difficult to find any sort of Chinese influence in the actual canonical text itself. But in terms of practice, obviously they did modify things, and that was kind of an ongoing process. And then some of the, especially with some of the great Chinese Vinaya masters who sort of established ways of doing things in China, and so they modified the practice, but the texts were still kept. Yeah.
And at one point they decided to make the whole China one school, like maybe both Sri Lanka, so then there's a diversity of different stuff in China, and then they decided all to come with a group to the school.
When was that? I think it was a similar period, maybe around 500 or something. I think. Again, it's a centralizing, you know, it's a government thing. The government wants, the Chinese government always wanted to centralize everything. Okay? In China? Well, diversified in the sense of developing the Chan school and the Pure Land and so on, Tiantai and all of those. So yes, both of those things were going on, but they did unify the Vinaya lineage. So all the sort of central Vinaya matters were done under the Dhammaguptaka school. But of course, that doesn't mean that the practice was unified. It just means that they're all within the same context. Sorry? Yeah. Oh, it always does. Wherever you are.
Just naturally.
Because, I mean, without the Vinaya doesn't influence, you know, the teaching as such. So people can be teaching different things, and then you have a natural diversification in terms of you have some meditation monasteries and some study monasteries and some social service monasteries. So there's different emphasis and focus in that way. And then, you know, of course you have particular teachers who teach a particular emphasis. So, you know, there's always forces within Buddhism which leads to that kind of breakup and diversification, you know, and then corresponding forces trying to unify things and bring them together.
Relatively speaking.
There's still a lot of differences though. But again, you know, within the Theravadan sphere, they pretty much agree on the actual texts, although they don't actually agree completely on all the texts. Okay, so there's several texts which were added to the Burmese edition of the Tripitaka, which are not accepted in Sri Lanka. So even that's not entirely the same, but pretty much the texts are unified. But in terms of practice, there's some things that are similar and some things that are quite different. You know, so.